Like, whether it's stumped in front of it, she still uses a tongue quite often.
Oh, okay. I just thought I'd cover it. But more seriously,
the one thing that's often puzzled me is in late pregnancy, the extent to which the uterus and fetus shrinks the rumen down. Do you know much about it?
Well, what happens is it takes up space. It
pushes the rumen down.
But what we're trying to do is you can actually help overcome that by what you feed those cows. Yeah. Yeah, and that's all we're trying to do.
I think it must reduce the capacity quite a lot.
It reduces the capacity by a great deal. So one way to actually test that capacity thing, so if you take late calving cows as a group, and you take a group of cows that are within 3 weeks of calving, and give them the same amount of pasture split down the middle, so you've got late cows on one side, early calving cows on the other. Do I make that clear? Close cows on the other. And watch what happens. Those later calving cows, where the fetus is quite small, they'll just go whoop, take everything out of the feed straight away. The close cows don't. They have to take small feeds regularly. But that still doesn't mean you shouldn't have a thick rumen. So there's an estimation that's been around for quite a long time that if you've got a close cow on a forage-based diet, she needs to have feed in front of her for 20 hours a day to actually get fully fed.
Yep.
So if you've got guys just on pasture silage, that has to be there for those transition cows. Some of you might remember Chris Amon, the racing car driver. So with Chris, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to build on that because the other side of it as well, in that car, they get brought into the shed and are standing on the pads for extended periods of time. So the same principles pre-carving need to apply post-carving.
Yeah, we're going to touch on that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So if we look at Chris, Chris is a pretty good racing car driver. Formula One, and he approached dairy farming in the same way. So basically he said the biggest sin in Formula One is to run out of fuel. So I figure the biggest sin is to let my cows run out of food. So we were looking at his dry cows one day late in the afternoon, and he turned around and called his manager up and said these cows need more food. It's the only person I know who bought up a whole bunch of cull cows and have them doing 600 k's of milk solids in year one. Simply because you use the dry period to teach them to eat and never let them fit. Chris, by the way, didn't know much about mechanics. We were in his ute one day and broke down the back of the farm, so he jumps out, has a look under the bonnet, kicks the tyre and rings his wife. Which was quite interesting. But he was really, really good at understanding that philosophy. And sometimes teaching farmers, don't let your cows run out of food, especially your dry cows, especially your transition cows, those close cows. So we're getting back to how long should be there, 21 days ideal. What about autumn calving cows? Why are autumn calving cows or summer calving cows a separate issue? Thanks, Nikki. Heat. So what does heat do to a cow late pregnancy? So we've got two specific problems with that group of cows.
Calcium stress as well, with heat.
Sorry?
Calcium mineralisation, with heat.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of other metabolic things going on. But what they end up doing is those cows have short gestation. Okay, on average you're going to shorten the gestation by 4 to 5 days. Sometimes as much as 20 days. So how many of you have seen your autumn calving herds, your split calving herds, where the guys have suddenly claimed dead cows are all starting to calve? They're not. So in those herds, we deliberately say, look, go for 28 days for transition if you can in those cows. And heat is becoming an increasing problem. It causes other problems. They don't eat. You know, so you've got to be very careful about what you're doing. Specifically with respect to eat, we talked about having the capacity to eat. You've also got to have the motivation to eat, and you've got to have some of the right things in you to do it. We know that calcium metabolism is important. Pups talked about phosphate. But when we're specifically looking at amino acids, histidine has been shown to actually directly impact dry matter intake. Histidine is an interesting amino acid. Back in the, I'll show you my age, late 80s, early 90s, Professor Marshall McCulloch at Oklahoma, and he was the guy who probably coined the term TMR. He developed all the initial stuff with respect to that. So he was actually doing quite a bit of work with pasture and looking at particularly with respect to lignin and also with the amino acids that were there. Unfortunately, this guy didn't pay much attention to his own nutrition. He was a really big guy, and he had a stuffed heart, and he used to wander around everywhere with an oxygen tank, including flying, which was actually quite interesting. So not surprisingly, he dropped dead before he published it. But everyone decided that that wasn't important because mostly it applied to foragers. Some of that has now changed. So recently, the guys at Cornell, I think, have published quite a bit on histidine and dry matter intake. So what it's actually pointing out is that what you do need to pay attention to is the mix of amino acids, in other words, the true metabolizable protein that's being delivered from your diet to those transition cows. Because remember, who's got first priority? Calf's got first priority. So the calf's going to take everything it possibly can take, stuff the cow. So a lot of our high production cows in particular, trying to make milk, are also mobilizing muscle tissue, not just fat pre-carbic. And they're doing it during hot weather as well. So you've got a hot transition cow, she's really in trouble. She's doing all sorts of things wrongly, so you've got to look after them really well. They're probably the cows that are most affected by heat, but they show it the least. They just stand around doing nothing. Whereas your milk, as you can tell, either the production's gone down or the huffing and puffing by the time they've got to the dairy. So you understand what's going on, but you need to pay attention to those autumn calving cows. And I think it's one of the reasons that a lot of the LSE data was showing that the autumns had a poorer repro than the springs. Okay, so that's important. The complicating factor alongside that is going to complicate more and more herds are the number of cows being mated to beef bulls. Okay, so what's the problem we've got with beef bulls? We've got a calf that pitches a hell of a lot of protein, particularly in the last few days. Okay, and often goes for a slightly longer gestation. So we've actually got a cow now, and it takes up more room in the gut. So we've got a cow that actually needs more, but ends up getting less because of who she is. So quite often, I know some of my herds, and I know where we're going tomorrow, separating out the cows that are really close to calving and actually making sure all feed's getting taken to them rather than relying on them on the feed pad. So our next problem with our transition cows in particular, that does apply to all cows, is they're not very competitive. They need space to get that food in. So if you're feeding them with feed pad, trolley, whatever it is, or carved out blue gum tree in Queensland, which we've seen a few of those. They've got to have space per cow at the feed face, whatever it may be. And you're looking probably in an ideal world to make that about 2 metres. How many farmers do that on their feed pad? No, they don't, do they? They don't give them enough space. They don't give their milkers enough space. Let's face it. We want all our cows to eat at once. And remember, the space you're looking at generally, the smallest space that you should allow in a feed pad, is the width through the full abdomen of a pregnant cow. Is that 600 mil? Not very many cows. Okay, and they don't have time to come back because they're on the feed pad, then they're off. So they've got to all be able to eat at once, which is quite different to a herd in a TMR situation in a barn in a confined area. So you need to look at those management issues when you're wondering what went wrong. Why did my TMR, well designed for my transition cows, with all the minerals that are in, the right DCAD and the right amount of phosphate, and the magnesium's all okay, why do I still have problems? Okay, so it can be the time available to the cow, it can be the space available to the cow, it can be what they got in calf to, it can be what happened during the dry period, it can be what happened back in lactation, what happened over drying off. And there's a people error. So Paul's in a bit of trouble for actually agreeing to have us tomorrow. One, because he's just come back from Wellington, where one of his daughters was accepted at the bar. His son's getting married on Saturday. Then he's heading to Australia for a while. So we've got to put it in. But when he was away down in Wellington, they had a couple of cows, got a bit wobbly. Come back, what happened? They were expecting these young cows to eat on the feed pad. They're not very competitive. hadn't been bothered taking the trolley to the closest cows. What happens? Something goes wrong. Okay. Last order, things kept going wrong because I had a bunch of ketotic cows. Go and look at them, they're all the cows that were calving to Charolais, all Belgian blue, that actually needed a bit more time over calving and post-calving. And I guess when we get to calving, we've then got another issue, because remember our priority in all cases is to make these cows continue to eat. We want maximum dry matter intake within 10 days of calving, and we know we can get it. That's at more than 4% of live weight. Okay, so you need a target on there. So we want more than 4% of live weight by 10 days post-calving. But we have a cow that's programmed to not want to eat in those first few days post-calving. She still has that evolutionary predisposition to have to look after an offspring and protect it from the lions. Okay, so if she ran off to have feed, not going to have anything left when she comes back. And most of them don't anyway. If you've ever followed woolly beast or wild cattle around in Africa, but chances of survival for the young, particularly if your mother's a bit young or a bit old, are quite small. You know, everything's following you around. We get nice documentaries, and sometimes they touch on some of the problem, but they don't give you the full view of what's going on. In reality, if you're a cow or a woolly beast or any other ruminant out there, where's the safest place to have your offspring? Is it to go away from the mob and hide? Is it? No, it's not. The safest place to have your offspring would be bang in the middle of the herd. You go and look at most dairy herds and see where all the cows are calving. Because the dominant cows will calve in whatever they see as the best position, regardless of where it is, but preferably in the middle of the mob. Because they're going to get protected. It's the submissives that have to get out and go away. Because your offspring's not only at risk of predators, it's the risk of getting played with by other young animals, it's getting kicked around by other cows or other dams. You know, there's a whole lot of things going on that have nothing to do with predators. They have to do with the natural social order of cows. So that comes down to the next thing. You've got to give those calving cows space. Now, very often we're trying to control pasture, because pasture is going to cause a lot of our grief over calving, but you've got to give them big area. So how do you do that? Because quite often you try and squash them up, somebody's going to come to grief, they're not going to get enough feed, they're going to get disrupted. Go and watch them, what happens in a mob. If you're a submissive animal, and you lie down because you pick somewhere nice to have a calf, and the next minute someone gives you a shunt in the ribs, they've got to get up and go somewhere else. How many of you spent time watching what's going on in calving herd? Okay, there's a heap of stuff going on that is not conducive to having a quick calving with a nice healthy calf, which is what we're trying to do. So we've got to give them space. Look at things like putting the milkers through the paddock first to take all the tops off and get rid of the non-protein nitrogen. Take it down a bit, then you can give your dry cows and your calving cows a lot more space. Look at things like that. You've got to look at the management. Because you can, like I said, you can have the best diet in the world, but if the social attributes going on are not okay for all the cows, if the management's not okay, then things will go wrong. And one day wrong in a transition mob is about a week of grief post-calving or over-calving. So just watch out what goes on. Newly calved cows, priority, get to food and water ASAP. Ideally make sure you get calcium back into the system ASAP. In the early days of transition in New Zealand, we didn't have feed mixer wagons, we weren't allowed to have feed pads because they were going to cause all sorts of environmental problems. Very few people had in-shed feed systems. Most of you guys didn't have a job, because a lot of the feed companies, for example, were only supplying the guys who had town milk contracts, which all got chucked out of the system. So there wasn't a lot of stuff in terms of how did you do things? How do you get things right? So we had to play around with stuff. And I'm indebted to people like Paul Bardall, my brother, Patrick Todd, who was another vet that I worked with. Patrick also had a shoe-milking job. We were mixing up anionic salts and molasses and spraying them on grass, trying to get cows to eat it. With my brother, we were trying to drench cows. And for me, it was very personal. My brother broke his neck playing rugby when he was quite young. This is the one who's a dairy farmer. One, he's milking some of my cows. Two, I'm really busy and I don't have time to deal with down cows or calving. So the reality is there can't be any. Because he couldn't even needle in a vein. He still didn't have very good control of his hands and things like that. So it had to be something simple. And that's why I got into transition in the first place, way back in the 80s. So it's quite a long history of trying to get things right. That's what I did discover out of that. You can run calcium in both veins at once, at the same time, as fast as possible if you've got to get on to the next farm. Without getting off. And as a side issue, most people do not treat cows well enough. The first time round, we still give it one bag of calcium to a down cow, which was what happened in 50 years ago in a little Jersey, giving about 10 litres of milk a pig. Dealing with cows that are much bigger, that are giving a lot more milk, and you still think one bag, sorry, not you guys, but your farmers, still think one bag's going to work? No, doesn't. So you need to look at what's going on, work out how much calcium needs to be replaced and how much energy. And sorry, I've got sidetracked off that. So we're getting back to our calving cows, and if we've got our transition right, we're going to have a really quick calving that's trouble-free. We're not only going to have a healthy cow, you have to end up with a healthy calf. Okay, so that means a calf that's got the nutrition it required from the cow and gets good quality colostrum quickly. So that means the cow had to make good quality colostrum. So again, that comes back to your transition management and feeding to make sure that we've actually got all of those things right. Not all cows are equal. The debate is, do you get the calf away from the cow or do you rear the calf on the cow? What's the consensus? Quite frankly, there's only one. If the cow is going to rear the calf long term, that's fine, it stays with her. If she's not going to rear the calf, the sooner it's taken from the cow, the better. Because you don't want bonding. Bonding causes stress to both the cow and the calf when you ultimately separate them. Okay, so you want to get them away as quickly as possible. And it's really interesting when you watch cows, and again, this just happened by chance. My brother's farm used to flood a lot. And it was in the bottom of a large catchment area. He didn't want to get up in the middle of the night, shift cows when it's raining, so just leave the gates open. The raceways were about a metre above the pasture level, and the cows could come back within 4 inches to the feed pad whenever they wanted. Now, his new calves were actually housed right adjacent to the feed pad. The cows could see them, hear them, smell them. How many cows used to hang around looking for their calf? So the only cows that used to come back and hang around looking after the calf were the ones that had actually spent more than about 9 to 10 hours with their calves. And there is quite a bit of work to show that it's actually around about 9 hours before cows bond with calves. So you take the calf away earlier than that. So that means clip them twice a day. Meanwhile, you've got this cow that you've got to make sure that she's back in terms of calcium, that she's able to eat, that she's getting all the other things that she needs as quickly as possible. That's really okay and easy to do if you've got a beefy or a cow that's only producing 3 or 4 litres. What are you expecting most of the cows that you're dealing with to do? You know, you want them up, don't you? They're quite high production quite quickly. So they've got a lot of milk. Can they eat enough in those first 2 or 3 days to replace the amount of milk you're going to take away if you milk them twice a day? No, they can't. Really simple, isn't it? So a big problem's downstream with reproduction, with metabolic disease, but a lot of those things come down to the fact that we've got the cow in poor energy balance because she didn't eat enough. So only thing we've got to do for most of us to get around that is stop milking the cow. Milk the cow once a day. An Australian asked me once in the 90s if I was going to get deported. One, for teaching cows to feed farmers to feed their cows better, and two, for telling them to put the cows on once a day. You try telling Americans that, they have hysterics. Okay. Worse are the guys in Britain. Because in Britain, in particular, we have a history of steaming up, and it's where probably transition management got a little bit of a bad name with some people. Because there was a belief, particularly amongst the high-producing guys, that a cow was only good if she calved with an udder that she could barely walk around that was leaking milk, okay, which we know is not the case, not an indication of good performance post-calving, except maybe in heifers, but it's not an indication of what's happening. It's not what we want. It's actually just conducive to mastitis and a hell of a lot more inflammation, which is also conducive then to a cow that eats less, loses condition too rapidly, and has poor reproduction. So it's getting all of those things right that are important, is important with transition. So that's the other reason why one of my standard recommendations always used to be colostrum cows only get milk once a day. And if they're not eating, they don't get milked at all after the first milking. So if you talk to Paul about that, you'll find out with cows that he's having a lot of twins at the moment. It's periodic for them. A lot of those cows may not get milked for 3 weeks after the first milking. They won't get milked until they start to eat properly. Because if we take milk away from those cows before they're eating enough to replace it, is that cow going to recover? They tend to go backwards and lose a lot of weight.
Is driving intake with those cows being measured by collars or just observation?
In Paul's case, yeah. Observation. Okay. Basically wants cows that look like they're having twins again quite quickly after calving, depending on living feed. Yep. So remember, a lot of these guys started these diets before collars were available. Paul's a very good stockman. They do have other people with collars. So that's where the whole thing with Ryan and the guys at Waimahi and Omaru came from, with all that big data thing, was actually going down there, dealing with metabolic problems, telling them that they look at some of these farmers in terms of their transition management, in terms of what they feed beforehand, and that cows that go on to once a day are the ones that reach peak appetite the fastest post-calving. I was talking to a consultant, well, I got a phone call from a consultant in Australia, Queensland, going to be Queensland. This comment was, these guys are stuck in the 70s, how the hell do I get them to move? How do I get them to actually feed their pre-calving cows? Because most people, if nothing else, they do know if you underfeed a cow pre-calving, good chance she won't get milk fever. Might not stand up, might not do a few other things, but it's the simplest way to avoid milk fever, starve the cows pre-calving. I'm sure that's what the old system used to be. I've probably bored most of you a lot by now.
You still have another 5 minutes, because we ran 5 minutes.
Yeah, we ran 5 minutes.
I wonder if we have any questions.
Do you have any questions?
If there's any questions, I guess the pilot.
Do I want a question from you?
So I remember a while back, when I first heard you talking about milking freshly cow or colostrum cows once a day, and there was a couple of rules that you said they've got to be fully milked out by 12 hours or something. Can you run
through there are definitely some rules about if you're going to put those cows, particularly high performance cows, on once a day, is that they must be milked out ideally within 12 hours of calving. So if they calve overnight, they must be getting milked that morning. If they calve during the day, they must get milked that afternoon.
Completely.
And they get milked out completely, and they get calcium at the very least down their throats. One way or another, boluses are the best. Two boluses if you want a big cow. And that's where starter drenches came from. I couldn't get anybody in the Northern Hemisphere to actually send us boluses here in New Zealand. Okay, we're going back to the 80s, by the way. Quite a long time, before half of you were born, I suspect. So we had to start mixing up stuff here. Agri-Feeds agreed to mix calcium chloride with molasses. My young nieces, who are about 3, agreed to do the taste test. Literally, this is what happened. And then we put it out with the cow, put it out with the colostrum cows. And then I got my brother, then we started mixing up drenches with a bit of protective fat in them, trying to get energy back into the system. But boluses were a lot easier. But New Zealand was not seen as a big market for things like that. You know, and I'm not joking with that a lot of you guys wouldn't have a job, because when I started doing with pure nutrition and cow management, basically told New Zealanders don't need stuff like that. So it was actually quite important. But getting back to those once a day cows, they must be milked out. And they must then get fed properly. and they must get water. No bloody electric fences around your colostrum cows. Now watch what they do. They will eat to a barrier, turn around and come back. So if the barrier is quite close to the gate, they turn around really quickly. And like I tell my farmers, if your colostrum cows are going to make a difference to your feed budget, you're stuffed. You know, 3 days of ad-lib feeding colostrum cows, or 4 days, is going to cause problems with your budget if you've got too many cows. You know, it's really simple. You're not going to aim to feed them, but you want to get those cows as full as possible, as quickly as possible.
Another interesting one, so is when this information was starting to become more common, farmers would say, but if I milk them out, if I milk my cows out completely, they'll go down. Yeah. So it's really interesting, the evolution that's happened. You know, if they were managing to control a proper problem through not milking the cow, not taking the calcium away, whereas, you know, the better option is to milk out fully and then not doing any more milkings.
Yeah, because your mastitis risk and everything's there. You've got a whole lot of things going on in those cows, and they're going to have a downstream effect. I think when you're looking at what is the success of your transition management, it doesn't just include what's going on over carbon. It includes what happens at least in the first 3 weeks of mating, because you're setting up your follicle quality at that point, setting up a whole lot. There's enough things can go wrong after that. Plenty of things can go wrong, whatever you're doing, but you want to get as many of the things that you can control right. But I think in a lot of cases in New Zealand, what we don't get right is actually the management of cows. They're in the wrong mob, the mobs are too big, they're not getting picked up enough, they're not getting fed enough, they don't get enough water. And it doesn't matter how good you, and this doesn't just apply to transition cows, by the way. This applies throughout the season. So it doesn't matter how good your ration is, but it's not getting eaten by the right cows in the right frame of mind at the right time, it won't work for you. And to come back to another thing about that Pat brought up earlier, and I meant to comment on it before, about having the high production cows and you're setting up diets for the average cow. Maybe interested to know that there's some work done in Germany, probably the mid-80s. And what they were doing, they weren't actually looking at intake, they were looking at something else, but they were using radioactive isotopes in the feed. And then they actually realised that if the cows had enough room, the high-producing cows actually ate more than the low-producing cows. So they could fix the diet for the average cow. The high-producer did actually eat more, the low-producer ate less. That does not apply to the same degree to pasture. You could be aware, because that's got a lot of physical things to it too. Some low-producing cows have got quite fast mouths. And I've never yet met a big Holstein Friesian cow that did this twice as fast as a Jersey. Just think about it. They might eat a little bit more, but they do not eat proportionately more. So big cows have to be able to eat more on a feed pad or get more in the shed, but you have to have space. Because being a big cow that's capable of high production does not guarantee that you've got the mental skills to fight off a little cow. Okay, so when farmers often talk about high production cows don't get calf, they're often referring to the highest producing cow or a high producing cow in their herd. And they'll say things like, oh, that cow's always skinny. You've all heard that, haven't you? No, she's always skinny. My high producing cow, she's always skinny. Guarantee that cow, if she's a high producing cow and she's always skinny, one of two things is going wrong. You're not feeding his cows enough in the first place, or there's some management of feed that doesn't allow her to eat enough, or she's a wimp. Okay, so if she's a Canadian animal, she's probably a wimp. If she's come out of New Zealand genetic, she's probably aggressive. Okay, and I mean, that is the reality, that's how we select our cows, is that there are reasons for them being like that. Okay, but basically, if you're looking at a lot of Canadian genetics, they're actually wimps. You know, and there is some nice work out at University of British Columbia looking at cow behaviour and stuff. And I was actually in Canada a few months ago, and it was interesting talking to things that were changing there, and that they're actually starting to look at cows because a lot of people have stopped putting them in stanchion barns and things like that. The other thing that came out increasingly around the world, by the way, is actually these guys couldn't grow crops in the winter in the past. So they had to leave all their maize ground fallow, which is not good for methane. Climate's changed. Now they can grow something there over winter. So that's, if it doesn't catch a light, that's doing quite well. I thought it'd be 5 minutes.
So as a management practice, if you're trying to build up to maximum dry matter intake in that first 10, 14 days, would it not make sense to sort of potentially only milk them once a day?
Yeah, you can milk them once a day as long as you like.
Yeah.
But certainly the critical time is those first 3 to 4 days. And then watch the cows. Either if you've got some form of electronic monitoring, you'll see that rumination times come up. And we're probably looking for most of the cows that you deal with somewhere around 580, 600 plus minutes at least. If you're looking at cows visually, stand behind them, the gut will definitely be wider than the udder. Okay? They'll have filled in all that space. So that was the only way we could do it before. If you're not sure, don't milk the cow. The same as if you have actually put a cow in the herd. It's probably my first draw of all, guys. If you're not happy about the cow, don't milk it. Skipping a milking, getting some calcium, maybe some B12, that's fixed more cows than most vets. I am a vet, by the way, for the rest of my sons.
Do you find that they're able to re-enter the herd after the period of being milked?
Sorry?
The collagen cows that bulls opting not to milk can then re-enter the herd and reach that peak milk production.
Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. The last year that I owned dairy cows before I sold them, I had a cow that had twins and she'd fallen in the drain, didn't look too good, so she was unmilked for 3 weeks and she still managed to do over 700 k's of milk solids and get back in calf. Yeah. We don't give them enough time often, and the simplest thing we can do sometimes is just skip milking. You can do that for Christmas or the Saturday night out as well, but whatever you do, make sure it's a routine. But honestly, look at what's going on. The other time that works, particularly in early lactation, bad storm, or the weather's suddenly changing, don't milk the cows. If their energy output's gone up, and they're going to need to keep that energy output, and you haven't got any other way of sticking a whole lot of energy in because Alltech didn't develop, or some of you guys didn't deliver a whole heap of protected fat really quickly so that we can stick 500 grams into the next feed, then the reality is skip milking.
It's standard practice in Taranaki with big storms for your clients, so.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. I find the high production guys are really easy to convince milk to go once a day or skip a milking. The guys who are doing 300 a cow, they're really hard. The other ones who probably shouldn't be milking at all, which should be a once a day. You can have cows in the main mob on once a day again. Like I say, look, watch what's happening with your social groups as well.
Thanks very much, Sue. Awesome. Thank you.